This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. I'm Hamilton Fish from the Nation Institute in New York City. See me later and I'll extend your subscription. I just want to say that it's a real honor for Jonathan and myself to have been invited to the stage at the Lensic. It's always in our minds been one of the premier venues in the country for discussion of serious ideas and public values. Give yourself a hand. Jonathan Schell began his career at the New Yorker magazine, where he was a staff writer from 1967 until 1987. In 1982, he published his reflective work on the nuclear question, The Fate of the Earth, which first appeared in three parts in The New Yorker, became a bestseller, and was hailed by The New York Times as an event of profound historical moment. The book received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, among other awards, and was nominated for the Pulitzer, the National Book Award, and the National Critics Award. He's the author of now 13 titles, including two books from the Vietnam period, The Village of Ben Suc and The Military Half, as well as several books that easily comprise our culture's most thoughtful and uncompromising body of work on the nuclear question and national and global politics. The Gift of Time, The Unfinished 20th Century, The Unconquerable World, A Hole in the World, which we were very proud to publish at Nation Books, and The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of the Nuclear Danger. Jonathan has been a columnist at Newsday and New York Newsday. He has taught at Emory and Princeton universities, at New York University, Wesleyan University, at Harvard, at the Institute of Politics, and later at the Shorenstein Center on the Press, and at Yale, where he's been for the past 5 years. Of course, in my impartial estimation, all of these lofty posts pale next to his primary allegiances, the Nation Institute in New York, where since 1998 he has been the Harold Willens Peace Fellow, and the Nation Magazine, where during the same period he has served with unique distinction as the Peace and Disarmament Correspondent. Please welcome a shining light in American journalism and letters, Jonathan Schell.
Well, thank you, Ham, for those super abundantly generous words. And I also want to thank the Lannan Foundation for the honor of being included in this marvelous series of speakers. I understand that your last speaker was Lester Brown, and I think that what I have to say this evening, in all likelihood, is going to be following quite naturally upon that. So let me begin. On July 16th, 1945, in the desert at Alamogordo, in this state, a couple of hundred miles south of here, the United States detonated history's first atomic bomb. The infernal thing had, of course, been invented and put together an hour's drive to the northwest of here at Los Alamos, and the first use came on August 6th of that year at Hiroshima. Since then, the riddle of the bomb, which is also the riddle of human survival, has pretty much baffled the world. People have pondered it, worried about it, protested it, fallen in love with it, from time to time gotten obsessed with it, and most of all, pushed it out of mind. And for those of us who are still concerned about nuclear danger, probably the primary fact that we have to face is that we're in a period right now of deep, if not total, forgetfulness of this issue. And so that's going to be my topic this evening. I want to do a quick analysis of our current amnesia and then propose what I think might be a new way of approaching the problem and bringing it before the public. Now, these events are, of course, billed as readings and as conversations. So what I've decided to do is alternately speak a little and read a little before turning to the conversation with my friend Hamilton Fish. So let me begin by suggesting that a very peculiar situation has arisen. We know, and we've known it for 60 years now, that there's no city on Earth that cannot be destroyed by a nuclear weapon of the appropriate size. Some of the weapons even have a handy dial on the side so you can boost the yield to cover the size of your target. We know that there are 20,000 plus nuclear weapons in the world. We know that the number of states possessing them, now numbering 9, has been rising slowly but steadily across the nuclear age. We know that the moment is approaching when groups that are not states, that are smaller than states, such as terrorist groups, will be able to acquire this technology or even a ready-made bomb. And we know finally that the large nuclear powers, though reducing their stockpiles, plan to keep many thousands in perpetuity with no idea of giving them up altogether. And on the contrary, they're actually refurbishing and renewing their nuclear arsenals right across the board. There's no exception to that among the 9. And of course, it's true of the United States, where there's a plan to bring to create something with the sort of sleepy sounding euphemism, the reliable replacement warhead. Which sounds like something you take to put yourself to sleep at night, to really substantially replace the most of the, if not the entire, nuclear arsenal. So, in view of all of that, these things that we know, and if we think about it, we realize that we do know them, they're not hidden things, I don't hesitate to affirm that in its urgency and sweep, the nuclear danger is still, today, right now, the greatest and most acute of the dangers that humankind faces. And yet, as I say, that issue has pretty much dropped out of the public mind, and the whole topic has acquired a kind of musty, a sort of 1950s air. And if you raise the subject, people are really, quite honestly, tend to react with a surprise, as if to say, oh, is that still a problem? And actually, the state of opinion is a little weirder than that, because if you poke a politician and press them a little bit and ask them, well, what are the most important things facing the United States and the world today? They will actually answer, well, it might be something to do with nuclear proliferation. In fact, back in 2004, John Kerry and George Bush were asked this in their foreign policy debate, and there was a rare moment of unanimity. They agreed that nuclear proliferation was the most important thing. And in fact, it came up this year in the primaries in one of the Democratic debates. Charles Gibson of ABC was moderating. And I remember he did actually ask about the nuclear question. Quite a thoughtful and interesting exchange occurred between the Democratic candidates. But then the whole thing died. The story had no legs. The media went on to whatever nonsense was current at that time. And it absolutely sank like a stone. But there it was on national television. But it just got no traction. So the question is, why has this fog rolled in? And mind you, I'm perfectly aware that as a general proposition, people really just love not to think about what nuclear bombs are and what they might not do, but what they might do. And I say that's pretty well understandable, and I feel it very much myself. It's frankly a hideous business. It's not something that you want to dwell on all the time or even a lot of the time. It oppresses the spirit. But nevertheless, it's also true that people have, sort of in a rush, in a kind of boom and bust way, turned their attentions to this. And I think that there are some other less innocent and less creditable reasons, if you will, for the current inattention and silence. And one of them is that I think since the Cold War, and then even more so since 9/11, our country has told itself the wrong story about itself. We've lacked self-knowledge. We've misinterpreted ourselves and our place in the world, willfully, I would say. Of course, at the end of the Cold War, we christened ourselves the sole superpower, or otherwise we were called the hyperpower. And even we began to consider ourselves as a kind of imperial master, a global imperial master indeed. You know, I can remember the time when when the phrase U.S. imperialism was hurled by left-wing people at the establishment who jumped up and down and complained and said that was a libel on them in the United States. Well, round about 2001, 2002, 2003, and certainly right after 9/11, suddenly that phrase became a term of praise and approbation, and it turned out to be a benign empire, and the idea that the U.S. was the greatest empire since Rome, and really the first global empire ever to exist, gained credit, and really began to move into a kind of central position in policy. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that was a profound, sort of 180-degree misreading of history, brought on by both the arrogance and the corruption of power. For it's not just individuals, after all, but countries, too, that can be corrupted by power. And I think that we seem to collectively think that what the 20th century had been about was that the big powers had kind of fought it out, the Nazis and the Soviets and France and England ourselves, and we'd won. We'd sort of come out on the top of the heap, and we're now the king of the hill and thus fit to run the world. Now, my own view, quite to the contrary of this, is that one imperial power after another in the 20th century, one superpower after another, bit the dust. And why was that? It was not the rivalry with one another so much as that local peoples in India, in Indonesia, in India, in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in fact, all around the world, found that they had the will and also the power to resist empire. And these empires bit the dust one after another. So you can imagine how horrified I was to find that my own country, at exactly the moment when the sort of imperial run was expiring, was trying to get back into the imperial business and on that grandiose scale. So here's my first excerpt, and this is from my book, The Unconquerable World. This was written just as the United States was about to go into Iraq. Empire, the embodiment of force, is the antithesis of self-determination. It violates equity on a global scale. No lover of freedom can give it support. It is especially contrary to the founding principles of the United States. Historically, imperial rule has rested on three kinds of domination: military, economic, and political. The United States enjoys unequivocal superiority in only one of these domains, the military, and here only in the conventional sphere. And any attempt at regime change in a country equipped with even a modest deliverable nuclear arsenal is out of question for the United States. American economic power is great, yet in this domain it has several equals or near equals, including the European Union and Japan, who are not likely to bend easily to American will. But most important, in the political arena, the United States is weak, precisely because in the contemporary world, military force no longer translates easily into political rule. Covenants without the sword are but words, Hobbes said. Since then, the world has learned that swords without covenants are but empty bloodshed. The Romans in ancient times were able to convert military victories into lasting political power. The United States today cannot. In the political arena, the lesson of the world revolt, that winning military victories may sometimes be easy, but building political institutions in foreign lands is hard, almost always impossible, still obtains. The nation so keenly interested in regime change has small interest in nation building and less capacity to do so. Can cruise missiles build nations? Does power still flow from the barrel of a gun or from a B-2 bomber? Can the world of the 21st century really be ruled from 35,000 feet? Modern peoples have the will to resist and the means to do so. Imperialism without politics is naive imperialism. In our time, force can win a battle or two, but politics is destiny. Now, in that imperial story that unfolded in spite of these warnings from me, the bomb was really like a character that walked in from the wrong drama, probably a Cold War story. And of course, the end of the Cold War was the pivotal moment here, because it brought with it the terrible illusion that because nuclear weapons had been created to buttress, or supposedly had been created to buttress the policies of the Cold War, that its end would bring their end. And of course we know that nothing like that happened. Really, I would say that the end of the Cold War was a kind of a miracle, if you consider something that is quite positive and entirely unexpected to be what a miracle is. And the unintended miracle, which something that came completely as a shock, really deserved a planned miracle in response. And in my view, and I said so at the time, that should have been the abolition of nuclear weapons. And with the global quarrel gone, what about an effort to get rid of the world-menacing weapons that had been justified by the quarrel? Well, of course, none of that happened. Instead, what happened was the kind of deep silence about the whole question that we're still in. But that deep silence was in itself probably as important as any dramatic and self-conscious and announced decision that has ever been made in the nuclear age, because it really set the tone for everything that would follow. Because while we were kind of turning away from our own nuclear arsenals and even managing not to see the Russian ones that were pointed at our noses still, people around the Third World noticed. India and Pakistan noticed and blew off nuclear weapons in 1998 in that series of tests. Iraq noticed, and Saddam Hussein started down that path in this period. Iran noticed, North Korea noticed, and they are a nuclear power now. And they said to themselves, well, we see that the other nuclear powers, led by the United States, are going to keep their weapons, and that's the kind of world we're going to live in, and so we better get ready for it and get some of these weapons to ourselves. In other words, everybody noticed what was happening, but the nuclear powers, whose arsenals thus became invisible to themselves. Now, the result was that we became, and still are, caught in a net of nuclear relationships that really we can't correctly perceive because we can't see or refuse willfully, as I say, to see the strands of it that we ourselves have woven starting back in 1945. And in this, as in so much else, it's really necessary to snap out of the imperial mindset, which I think is the kind of controlling factor in this willful ignorance, and to begin to learn what empires can almost never do, which is to see ourselves as others see us. Because, in fact, one way of reading this imperial bid for global power is that when it turned out, and people began finally to notice it around the turn of the century, that proliferation was not ending after all, we decided to go in for the imperial solution. What was the imperial solution? It was to stop proliferation by military force. Where did that lead us? Into the sands of Iraq, where there were no nuclear weapons. Meantime, North Korea was heading down that path. This tough policy turned out to have no application there. Meanwhile, Iran was getting busy with its nuclear power, which conceivably might be preparation for nuclear weapons. We don't know. In any way, there doesn't seem to be any way to stop it. And really, part of the imperial delusion, which has now been exposed, was that we could restore our superpower so humiliatingly threatened by this threat from tiny countries who might put together a nuclear weapon by stopping others from getting the bomb by force and thereby reserving it to ourselves. Well, it's no secret that whole effort has been crashing and burning and has pretty well gone down in flames. And I indeed think, and I'll talk a little bit more about it later, that the choice in the United States of President Barack Obama as president signals a recognition of at least the salient features of that change. And so I think we have real hope that a post-imperial policy can be born, although I have my shadows of doubts, which we can perhaps explore later. In any case, I think if you put all that together, what you arrive at is a kind of, that the superpower developed a kind of super illusion, which was this imperial illusion. This whole business about American exceptionalism and the sole superpower, even when we just tirelessly and just by rote talk about American leadership on everything under the sun, I think was part of that self-misunderstanding. The reality was that we were one country among many. A very powerful one, to be sure, even the most powerful, but only one, inhabiting in a planet placed at risk by our own collective actions. We belong to what the diplomat George Kennan called a community of fate, and what Martin Luther King called an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. These, I suggest, were profound moral insights that were also practical, and of course King called himself a practical idealist. So all of that leads me now to my second topic, which is the new context in which I think we might try to see this dilemma. Because I think that really, when you look at it, Kennan's community of fate is much larger and goes much deeper than even he could have known when he spoke those words, which were back in the 1980s. To put it very simply, we've learned in the last several decades that we face something entirely new in all history, and that is a crisis of the entire natural order, of the fabric of life, that is, of Earth. We live in an age of extinctions, and the Earth is now experiencing a faster rate of extinction than at any time in the last 100 million years, and scientists tell us that fully half of existing species are in jeopardy by the end of this century if we continue down the present path. So we can see now that the threat of extinction, human extinction, by nuclear arms was only the first of these threats of extinctions to appear. We started by threatening ourselves and went on from there. And, of course, to this we have to add the chief ecological danger, which is, of course, global warming, and which is the only other specific threat that rises to some kind of a comparable level to the nuclear danger. And the danger here is, of course, the destruction or mutilation over time of the ecosphere of the Earth as we've known it. Now, I think that there are a couple of pretty good reasons why people were unable to fit these things together into a single picture until quite recently. And for one thing, the ecological consciousness really didn't begin to register until Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, in the early 1960s. I don't have that date, I'm sorry. Although she did say, and in a phrase that now resonates more apparently than it did then, speaking of polluters, she said, "They will end by destroying the Earth." So the warning was there right at the beginning. And I think the reason, once again, is that the nuclear question, or another reason, is that the nuclear danger grew up really in a context of war and peace. And that was a very compelling historical framework in which to look at it, and people didn't as yet have the ecological framework in which to see it. And then when the ecological framework did come along, and when people understood that it wasn't only nuclear weapons but other things that posed a threat to the whole ecosphere, then that grew up in the realm of production, of economics and production. And so once again, it seemed to be something different. But now I think we can see that that whether it's production or it's destruction, the results can be the same, which is this jeopardy to the natural order. So now we have a fast way of doing ourselves in, discovered in 1945, and a couple of slower ways through global warming and other processes. And truly, it would be a pity to save the Earth from gradually overheating only to burn it up in an afternoon in a thermonuclear holocaust. But I, in fact, see even a deeper continuity or a longer continuity between the nuclear dilemma and the ecological dilemma, and, in fact, some of the earlier threats that appeared, the vast slaughters of genocide and so forth that appeared in the 20th century. And I'd like now to read an excerpt. It's from an essay that I haven't published, but it draws some of these connections. And I'll now read from that essay. The atomic bomb announced a revolution in the relationship of humankind to the rest of life, to itself and to Earth. The event's antecedents were the increasing destructiveness of the instruments of war and the eruption of genocide as a modern political project in the first half of the 20th century. And the sequel has been the protracted awakening in the century's second half to the damage that human activity is doing to other species and to the terrestrial environment. Damage that alters not just the human condition, but the condition of all life. Thus, historically, the peril of human extinction in a nuclear holocaust is the middle term that links genocide and ecocide. The antecedents to the event of 1945, the event itself, and the sequel exhibit a common theme. All are acts of extermination. Extermination almost always involves mass killing, but mass killing and extermination are not the same. Let us consider genocide. Although historically mass killing has been the chief instrument of genocide, the definition of genocide does not hinge on the numbers killed. It hinges on the intention to destroy utterly a particular definable community, whether this might be a people, a race, an ethnic group, or, according to some of the broader definitions, a social class or religious or ideological sect. The definition is rooted in the origin of the word, which means to kill a kind, a genus of human beings. Samuel Lemkin, who led the campaign to establish the Convention on Genocide, even argued that the annihilation of a tradition or culture, for example, through repression or expulsion of a people from their homeland, should, even in the absence of mass killing, be considered genocide. Genocide could also be accomplished, theoretically, by somehow destroying the regenerative capacity of a people, by preventing them from reproducing. And human extinction, likewise, could theoretically be brought about without any actual killing. For example, if somehow the male sperm were suddenly to be corrupted on a global basis, no individual person would be killed, but the species would die out in a kind of lingering scene. And what is more common in the natural world than that anything like that happens is that the environment that sustains a species is destroyed. And indeed, the environmental damage really forms a kind of third component, along with genocide and the extinction of species, in what I call the books of life. Because an ecological system shares with a species the property that it can continue in perpetuity, but it also can be killed off and lose its regenerative capacity. So once destroyed, it too can never be recovered. And the particular web or fabric of independent species that make up an ecosystem plays much the role that a genome plays in the life of a single species. And of course, the ecosphere, the ecosystem of Earth, which I think Lester Brown probably told you about, is of course the largest of the singular ecosystems whose loss comprises all the others. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. On the first day, he created light. On the second, the firmament. On the third, the seas. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass and herb, yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit, after his kind." And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the water bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in firmament of heaven." Now, whether we are religious or not, I think that we can say that not until our time, when human beings acquired the power to unmake the creation or the natural order, quickly through nuclear war, slowly through global warming or what have you, did these verses of Genesis become a political text. Now, I want to just try to zero in a little bit on what I consider to be the essence of this new variety of peril, this new order of perils that we have visited upon ourselves. And once again, the theme here, and I'm going to quote a passage from my book, The Fate of the Earth, is that it's not killing per se, horrible as that is, and much as we should oppose killing per se, as it is actually preventing birth, preventing the regeneration of these, what I'm calling, books of life. So I'm going to read again. "The individual would misconceive the nuclear peril if he tried to understand it primarily in terms of personal danger. For the nuclear peril threatens life above all, not at the level of individuals who already live under the sway of death, but at the level of everything that individuals hold in common. Death cuts off life. Extinction cuts off birth. Death dispatches in the nothingness afterlife each person who has been born. Extinction, in a stroke, locks up in the nothingness before life all the people who have yet to be born. For we are finite beings at both ends of our existence, natal as well as mortal, and it is the natality of our kind that extinction threatens. The threat of the loss of birth, a beginning that is over and done with for every living person, cannot be a source of immediate selfish concern. Rather, this threat assails everything that people hold in common. For it is the ability of our species to produce new generations which assures the continuation of the world in which all our common enterprises occur and have their meaning." That's the end of that quotation. After all, what are our responsibilities as human beings, as individuals and societies, set down on Earth in this particular historical moment, at this juncture in the story of humankind and indeed of life on Earth? The old ills are all still around us. The poor you always have with you, and we have them still, or we are them. Oppression and injustice still hold sway, and these responsibilities claim us as much as they ever did. But at the same time, this new array of unprecedented responsibilities that I'm trying to describe this evening lay new claims upon us. and they can be summarized, as I say, as the responsibility to preserve the natural foundations of human and other life from human destruction. Once again, to borrow religious language, I'd say that what we're doing is more and more as if we're flinging the creation back in the Creator's face, as if to say, this wasn't good enough for us. We expected something better, as if to say, we weren't rich enough, or we weren't powerful enough. We didn't have a big enough car. And the beginning of wisdom, I think, is to accept the given world and, in fact, to be grateful for it. And it's in this broad spirit, I think, that we should approach the nuclear question, along with the other dangers I've been describing. So in conclusion, let me quote once more from The Fate of the Earth. And I'm talking here about the nuclear danger and about nuclear weapons, but I think that these words might well apply to global warming and to the other ecological dangers that now are threatening us. So let me just close with that. Two paths lie before us. One leads to death, the other to life. If we choose the first path, if we numbly refuse to acknowledge the nearness of extinction, all the while increasing our preparations to bring it about, then we in effect become the allies of death, and in everything we do, our attachment to life will weaken, our vision, blinded to the abyss that is opened at our feet, will dim and grow confused. Our will, discouraged by the thought of trying to build on such a precarious foundation, anything that is meant to last, will slacken, and we will sink into stupefaction, as if we were gradually weaning ourselves from life in preparation for the end. On the other hand, if we reject our doom and bend our efforts toward survival, if we arouse ourselves to the peril and act to forestall it, making ourselves the allies of life, then the anesthetic fog will lift. Our vision, no longer straining not to see the obvious, will sharpen. Our will, finding secure ground to build on, will be restored, and we will take full and clear possession of life again. One day, and it is hard to believe that it will not be soon, we will make our choice. Either we will sink into the final coma and end it all, or as I trust and believe, we will awaken to the truth of our peril, a truth as great as life itself, and like a person who has swallowed a lethal poison, but shakes off his stupor at the last minute and vomits the poison up, we will break through the layers of our denials, put aside our faint-hearted excuses, and rise up to cleanse the earth of nuclear weapons. Thank you.
Concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, I feel that we've all been invited, Jonathan, to witness an oft-deferred marriage of Jonathan Schell and Rachel Carson. Is it too early to offer congratulations?
Too early still.
What's been the response of your new in-laws, the environmentalists?
Pretty good. There are actually a number of environmental organizations that have traditionally taken on this issue, and I think more are doing so. One notable one is the National Resources Defense Council, which has always had a very strong anti-nuclear component. And there's a lot else going on as well.
And so without meaning to pry, how is the courtship?
It's just in its earliest stages.
All right. So stay tuned. Let's start with the moral and political Rosetta Stone of the modern era, the events which probably more than any other have shaped the times that we've lived in, Vietnam. You covered Vietnam for The New Yorker. You published two books based on your time there. What was the impact of this experience, and how has it influenced your work going forward?
Well, it was really a seminal experience. It was a profound shock on every level of my being. I was 23 years old. I went to Vietnam as a tourist, and by a series of events that I won't recount now, landed up in the middle of the war as a journalist. And I really was a kind of tabula rasa. I had no clear opinions on the war. Probably I thought it was a big mess, but we had to fight it and so forth. But what I quickly saw as I was out in the field watching the military operations was that the whole thing was a kind of absolutely made no sense in its own terms. That the entire apparatus of modern civilization, all the machines, the cars, the jeeps, the planes, what have you, which normally are pursuing some more or less sensible service, such as delivering children to school or stocking supermarkets or what have you, had been turned to senseless destruction. And it was absolutely clear, for example, that the United States supposedly was there to save and help the South Vietnamese people, but we were actually just killing them off. We were supposed to be advising the South Vietnamese army, but they ran away when the battle started. So the whole thing was an absurdity in its own terms. And that was what I was faced with. And so I think one of the lasting lessons that I took away from it, rather, you know, deeper than any policy lesson of the war, was that immense undertakings of countries that considered themselves civilized and perhaps were somewhat civilized in their domestic life could go completely awry and not just be a little bit crazy, but be fundamentally crazy, to be sort of functionally insane. And I think that prepared me to think about the nuclear question in the way that I do think about it, because I think that we find there that same sort of almost functional insanity, if you like.
Using Vietnam as a benchmark journalistic experience, and then thinking about the many articles and books that you've produced since, I'd like to just mention a couple of titles of yours, and at the risk of turning it into a game, see if you can give me a sort of concise phrase or summary that seems to capture what that book represents in the arc of your work.
Well, if I sum up my books in three phrases, no one will have to buy them again.
I'll play your game anyway. But certainly the two from the Vietnam era, Village of Ben Suc and The Military Half.
Well, I think I've already spoken to it, but there was one other lesson from that experience that I think has been lifelong. And that is that in a contest of violence, of violent power and political power very often, even usually, wins out. Because you had a ridiculous situation in Vietnam. What you saw over and over again was that the American forces were just winning almost all of the battles because we had such incredible superiority and firepower. And yet none of it mattered. So we won and we won and we won and we won until we lost. And the reason was that we had no chance of winning politically, that is to say, no chance of creating a government there or political institutions that could survive our withdrawal. So the application of military force was just quite futile, and that's a lesson that stayed with me, and in fact that I expanded upon in later writing.
Fate of the Earth.
Well, that's hard to sum that one up. I think maybe I've done my best in reading a few passages just now. What's at stake there, which is everything.
Observing the Nixon years.
Well, that was kind of a middle term between the Vietnam War and the nuclear question, because when you looked at the Nixon policies and when you looked at the whole crisis of the American Republic that unfolded in that time and under his administration, what was glaringly clear was that it had its roots in the Vietnam War, and above all in his attempt to continue the Vietnam War after the country in 1968 had really, in effect, made a decision to get out of the war. And in fact, he said he had a secret plan to end the war. But in seeking to go against the will of the public, he got himself involved in the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg, the plumbers, the breaking into the DNC, and all of those things which really were expressions of an attempt to continue a policy against the will of the American people. And at the same time, though, if you looked at the reasons, the geopolitical reasons for going into Vietnam, there was a very direct link with the nuclear question. It's a little bit complicated, and I'll just try to describe it in as simple terms as I can. But, you know, at the very heart of the nuclear dilemma and of nuclear policy in that era was the whole notion of what they called credibility. And the whole paradoxical and really contradictory idea was that you'd never have to fight a nuclear war if you looked so willing to fight one that people wouldn't attack you. And that was deterrence. But, of course, you couldn't actually ever put that theory to the test. You couldn't actually ever do it because you just blow yourself up and everybody else in the world. So you were in a situation of paralysis. So in that situation, it turned out that this whole idea of limited wars, which is what Vietnam was, took on a terrible burden because those were wars you could fight. And so those became wars where you had to demonstrate the credibility that you couldn't display in other in the nuclear sphere. And therefore, when everything went bad, you had to keep on fighting that thing indefinitely until finally the whole country went into rebellion and you had to leave.
The Unconquerable World.
Well, that's a book in which I really explore the great nonviolent movements of the 20th century. Starting with Gandhi, looking also at the Solidarity Revolution in Poland and Charter 77 in Czechoslovakia, and also Martin Luther King's movement here in the United States, among others that I look at. And I'd say that where that sort of fits in a way, is that what I had come to understand, first in Vietnam, but then in the nuclear question, was that violence had become, state violence had become bankrupt in its own house. You couldn't fight the big wars, you couldn't fight the little wars either. And I think we're seeing some sequels to that in Iraq, and I would add Afghanistan just now. So with violence being bankrupt in its own house, you might say a vacuum was created, because throughout history, violence, state violence, had been seen as what they call the ultimate arbiter, the sort of final decider. The person with the gun really had the final say and made things happen. But that wasn't the case anymore. And so, as I say, a vacuum was created. And I think that, lo and behold, almost miraculously, something began to be invented and is still being invented that steps into the role and fills the need. You know, what Henry James called the moral equivalent of war. And I think that that is what has happened with these nonviolent movements. And sometimes they're not nonviolent. In Vietnam, certainly the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were violent, and yet at the core of their strength was this political power, and they knew it and they said it.
In an earlier work, you traveled the world interviewing the leaders and, in many cases, iconic figures of the Cold War. Did it surprise you to learn in these encounters of their skepticism of the assumptions of Cold War and of their newly educated worldviews to the values that we would more typically associate with either peace movement or anti-nuclear forces?
Well, you know, it was very interesting because I think that when the Cold War ended, there were a whole array of people who suddenly felt free to express what they'd found themselves or believed themselves unable to express previously, which was their absolute horror at the idea of actually using nuclear weapons. Certainly, Ronald Reagan was one of those. There was a whole array of military figures, including the former commander of the nuclear forces of the United States, General Lee Butler, and an array of other generals whom I interviewed. And so suddenly they were free to express this. And also the senselessness, this insanity that I perceived, it turned out that they also perceived. Very interestingly, among those, of all people, was President Ronald Reagan, who, it turns out, we didn't really know it or appreciate it at the time, but he actually had a very deep moral disgust, feeling moral disgust at nuclear weapons, and that was what led him to come within an ace of an agreement with Mikhail Gorbachev at the Reykjavik meeting in 1986 to actually abolish them. It's something that's still rather underappreciated, but a remarkable and very important and invaluable historical precedent. So there were a number of people, a few only.
What prevented that agreement?
Well, what prevented that agreement was that it was, again, I mean, the nuclear dilemma is so full of paradox, it's just built paradox upon paradox. But in this case, it was Ronald Reagan's belief in Star Wars. Now, curiously, his belief in Star Wars permitted him at first to believe in the abolition of nuclear weapons.
Of course.
Because if you can defend against them, you don't have to have them, right? So, but then his championship of that goal rather deepened. But at that critical moment in Reykjavik, he insisted on having Star Wars, and Mikhail Gorbachev insisted that it be scrapped. Now, the tragedy was that either of them could have given way because the thing turned out to be a farce. It didn't exist. You didn't need to insist on having it or to insist on not having it. So they could have gone ahead and gotten rid of nuclear weapons and just forgotten about Star Wars. It was a tragedy of history.
And finally, your most recent book, The Seventh Decade.
Well, in that book, I try to catch up with where we are in the nuclear dilemma. And really, the main thing that's happened there is that it's become universalized. In other words, it's the proliferation not only to other countries and with all kinds of new countries waiting in the wings, but the danger of its moving out into the hands of terrorist groups and so forth. And this, of course, was predicted from the very beginning of the nuclear age. The atomic scientists knew this all very well, so we have no excuse for not having foreseen it, but here it is in our faces.
You wrote once that Hiroshima announced the possibility of the end of the world. What did you mean?
Well, something very simple, that if one bomb can destroy one city, and at the height of the Cold War, if you had about 70,000 bombs, and if you destroy the 70,000 largest cities in the world, that's the end of the world. But more specifically, it turned out that this ecological dimension was present. That wasn't something immediately apparent, except for the radiation, which is, of course, a kind of ecological thing. But it turned out that the damage to the ozone layer of the Earth, of so-called nuclear winter, being created through the lofting of particles around the Earth, and a whole host of other predictable and semi-predictable effects, pathogens racing through the globe, would really put you into the zone of ending the human species.
And then, so more recently in an appearance on the Charlie Rose Show, you said the double standard world in which the United States and eight other powers have nuclear weapons and give lectures and try to put pressure on the rest of the world not to have them, is just an unworkable thing. It's a self-defeating policy, and it's not going to stop proliferation. Now, are you describing arms control?
Well, I'm describing the abolition of nuclear weapons as the only feasible policy under present circumstances. Because, as I say, from the very outset of the nuclear age, it was clear to all people who understood it, such as the atomic scientists who were right around here at Los Alamos, that this cat was out of the bag, that there was no such thing as the secret of the bomb, that it really shared a quality with all scientific technology, namely that it's its very nature to spread. It's like a television. If you have a certain technology around for 60 years, it's going to be known. And then any competent person or group of persons who can get the proper materials will be able to build a nuclear weapon. So it's only now that that universalization, you know, born by the spread of the knowledge, is being actualized. And so then the question is, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to say, you who have nuclear weapons, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9 of them, we alone can have it, and others can't? And that puts you in the position of the imperial solution, which is no solution. It's hopeless to try to stop it by force. That is what has failed. That is what has been attempted and failed. So then the question becomes, how do you stop it? Because the problem is there.
This is what you call the disarmament war.
These are precisely what you condemn yourself to with this sort of imperial solution, the double standard solution, is to patrol the borders of the nuclear haves and the nuclear have-nots on a global basis, with more and more countries trying to get into the business and you waging more and more wars to stop them. And it's hopeless. Now, it just can't. It's unworkable as well as wrong.
Given the extraordinary body of work, the extent of the scholarship, the not widely proliferated public debate, but the general, I think, understanding of the central points you're making, it's very striking to me to compare the climate of, let's say, the early 70s with the recent political contest. In the 70s, it was heresy and probably political suicide to openly endorse first use of nuclear weapons. It was in the box. I remember last winter at tremendously entertaining Republican presidential debates. The question was, is there anyone on this stage who is willing to publicly declare that they would be inclined to use a nuclear weapon as a first strike? And all of the arms shot up. And in fact, when they realized that all the arms had shot up, several stepped forward around in front of their podiums in order to gain some kind of a physical advantage in the sort of hierarchy of willingness to do this.
Yeah.
Astounding, terrifying. But what is the shift in public discourse that so many years ago made it unthinkable and now makes it a badge of honor?
Well, first, let me say that during the Cold War and in the 1970s, although what you say is generally true, there was a situation in which the United States was ready to use nuclear weapons first, and that was in the European theater. And so the United States never did actually have a formal policy of not using nuclear weapons first. The idea was to compensate for Soviet conventional superiority in that theater. But I think, pretty well universal, at least among policyholders, was a policy against the preventive use of nuclear weapons. That is, the use of a nuclear weapon to stop, to hit another nuclear weapon or to stop someone else from getting a nuclear weapon. And I think that is what underwent this shocking revolution that was exhibited on the stage during that Republican debate. And, of course, what happened was 9/11 and the doctrine of preemptive, which really meant preventive war. And so they just sort of blindly and foolishly extended that, what was already a foolish policy in conventional terms, to nuclear weapons themselves and stepped up for the preventive use. And those would precisely be the disarmament wars that I was speaking of, and more particularly in that case of nuclear disarmament wars.
Well, it's still an unsatisfying explanation for me. I remember, for example, that your book precipitated the institutionalized opposition to nuclear weapons in the form of the nuclear freeze. And there was a period in the 80s where you couldn't run for office unless you endorsed the freeze. And in fact, as you've pointed out, Mr. Peace Through Strength himself endorsed the freeze, Ronald Reagan.
Well, he's that was a pretty interesting chapter in the whole story of nuclear weapons, because the Ronald Reagan's buildup was very important in evoking the whole freeze movement. In other words, he was building up, the message was stop doing that. He actually denounced and criticized the freeze because he wanted to continue with his nuclear buildup, but he found that his popularity was going off a cliff. And actually, in terms of support for the military buildup, it went from something like 80% to 20% in the first couple of years of his presidency. So he was in sore need of a political fix. Now, I think that he sincerely believed in Star Wars, technically, but it was also a political fix to his problem. So one of the strange ironies of history is that the freeze was very instrumental in giving birth to Star Wars. But then if you want more irony, Star Wars was instrumental almost in actually not just freezing, but abolishing nuclear weapons, and then in the final wrinkle, prevented that.
But in our comparatively short adult lifespan, we've seen millions of people in the streets of European cities protesting the installation of American double-track missiles. We've seen in the Freeze a national movement. In June 12th, a day which in a sort of impotent way is still remembered, but was an extraordinary experience for that era of a million people in Central Park. What's the genesis of the failure of all of this extraordinary outpouring of domestic and international resistance, with even to the degree of people at the highest levels? Do you see it as a problem of episode? Do you see it as a problem of continuity? Is it a problem of some citizen impotence that doesn't get translated into policymaking or legislation? I mean, we haven't had public protests of the magnitude that we've seen against nuclear weapons in any other sphere.
You know, first, I think that the protests did have an effect. After all, but what happened? The next thing that happened after the Freeze movement and so on was that, as I say, Reagan sort of co-opted it in a certain way with Star Wars and his own. But then what happened was that the end of the Cold War began to kick in. And one of the sort of lesser-known chapters of that is that Mikhail Gorbachev, of all people, was very influenced by leaders of the Freeze movement with whom he met at that time. And they were very important in his fashioning what he called the new thinking, which was, of course, the beginning of the end of the Cold War. So if we say that the Freeze failed, we have to keep in mind that not so many years after that, something better than the Freeze did actually occur, which was the end of the Cold War with it, and actual reductions in nuclear arms, which are, you know, have gone down about 50%, a very welcome event, although, as I say, there's no plan to get rid of the arsenals in the thousands on either side at this point. But really, your question...
And there's no check on proliferation.
And there's no effective check on proliferation, because neither the diplomacy that they're trying now nor military force is effectual, so it just goes on as it will. But I think to answer you, that's sort of almost a detail, what I just said. I think that something very visceral and elemental has been involved here. And that was that, you know, really throughout history, people have believed that the person with the biggest club, that the holder of superior military force really had his way in the world. There was somebody who once said, well, why do we have nuclear weapons? And it's one of the most persuasive answers I've ever heard. And the answer was, because we walk down the street in a different way. I mean, it's on that visceral level. And I think only now are we reaching a point where people are beginning to understand that these weapons don't actually confer the kind of power that people think they did. I think it may be only at this moment that that's beginning to sink in.
Shifting gears slightly, and in light of the sponsorship of this occasion by the Lannan Foundation and their interest in literature, and in fact their wise decision to award you with one of those coveted Lannan prizes a number of years ago, I've been very struck in following the books and essays and other written works in your career on this subject of the presence of literary values in the seams of the writing. And it seems that there's a kind of natural alliance with the nuclear topic. Words like paradox, irony, illusion, they seem inherently a part of the language of nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons doctrine, and indeed the history of the presence in our midst of nuclear weapons. I think of deterrence and proliferation, for example, which are both sides of the same coin. you embrace these opportunities, I think, to explore the literary side of this.
Well, just concentrating on these paradoxes for a moment, I think that really the nuclear age is shot through with at least one, innumerable paradoxes, but one that is perhaps key to all the rest. And that is that when the bomb was first developed, it was called the absolute weapon. And there was a conviction that the possessor of that bomb or a possessor of a nuclear monopoly would have absolute power. And those with the bomb would be in a category unto themselves in terms of holding sway in the world. But if you actually go back and look at the history of nuclear strategy, it's almost impossible to find an instance in which the United States, which is the history I know best, has actually secured a political advantage to itself, either by using, and I very much include Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the light of recent scholarship, or even of threatening the use of nuclear weapons. It's been done many, many times, including, for instance, during the Korean War. But it's never produced the effect that was desired. On the contrary, it turned out, as people realized at about the sort of late 50s, that possession of nuclear weapons in your arsenals actually paralyzed your military policies. And this led, in a way, to Vietnam, because the idea was, how can you escape the paralysis? The idea is, well, let's go and fight a limited war. And that turned out to just be another fiasco, a different kind of fiasco that had been born out of the nuclear dilemma. And so, really, to give you just one other example, there's a question of why Harry Truman threatened to use nuclear weapons as he did, not publicly, but within the councils of government during the Korean War. Well, it turns out that what his real reason for doing it was that he was about to fire General MacArthur. And he needed a way to show the Joint Chiefs of Staff that he was a tough guy after all. So what he did was to release certain nuclear weapons to be taken to the Korean theater with no intention of using them in order to show this toughness. So you could say, did the United States use nuclear weapons in the Korean War? And the answer would be yes, against General MacArthur. And that's typical of the feints and bluffs and illusions and of nuclear policy throughout the nuclear age. I could give you an analysis of the Cuban Missile Crisis that would show the same thing. I'll hold off on that.
It's more than a corruption of language. Yeah. I mean, we have Operation Iraqi Freedom. We have the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is, you know, certainly one of the more mischievous enterprises in the international arena. But is the presence of paradox and illusion at some level more in the nature of these forces that we seek to control, these nuclear forces?
I think it is in their nature, because although they grew up in the context of war, they almost immediately transcended war. In other words, what is a war? A war is a conflict in which people, two sides, use force to impose their will on the other and to somehow get what they want, to take over their country, to force their religion on them, to get their oil, whatever it might be, to achieve an objective. But when nuclear weapons were born into the world, they offered an excess of power in which all possible ends of war were destroyed along with the means. And so really, from the very start, they were incredible, not credible, as instruments of war. Mm-hmm. And the attempt to extract a military advantage out of them, whether by using them or threatening to use them, I think has been a vain one. And I could go on and give you more chapter and verse in that. When you look at the actual history of what was done and what happened and what the policies were. So they turned out to be perfectly useless. And right now, by the way, they're more useless than they ever were. I mean, do we really need to have an arsenal of several thousand nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert to blow up Russia? What is that about? And how do we like having them pointing a similar arsenal at us? Why do we endure that? For what end? Do we have a quarrel with Russia? No. Georgia, it's not enough.
And in some respects, Grenada is the only country that this massive nuclear power has been able to subdue.
A triumph of nuclear policy.
Yeah. In your remarks tonight, two words stood out, arousal and action. I wanted to ask what you meant by using those terms and what you were hoping for.
Well, I mean something very simple. I mean political action. I'm hoping that the public will return its attention to this issue again in the broader context of the larger ecological crisis. By the way, I'll just add in that context that I think a door has opened. There was an article written in the Wall Street Journal by, of all people, Secretary of State George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, former Senator Sam Nunn, and former Secretary of Defense William Perry, actually advocating the abolition of nuclear weapons. Now, if you go back in history and ask yourself, who is it that has championed nuclear arsenals? It has not been the American public, really, who don't warm to them very much. And poll after poll has said that they'd be happy to be rid of the whole thing. I don't think it's military people. At one time, it was. In the 50s, I think it was. But now, really not. I think that they have come to understand that these are not usable weapons. They would much rather have a conventional weapon. So I don't think that the attachment is there. The group that was attached was what you might call the nuclear priesthood. That is the civilian policymakers, the secretaries of state, the secretaries of defense, the academics, the people in the think tanks. And as they formed an implacable wall of opposition to any idea of actually ridding the world of nuclear weapons, which they considered that idea utopian, ridiculous, naive, all these words that they use. So the fact that that group is now coming around to an abolitionist position really opens a door that has been shut since 1946 and is now opening. And so I think that where arousal and action comes through is that the public needs to take it up and push the policymakers through that door. And by the way, Barack Obama.
I wanted to lead you to that. Yeah. And as the last question, really, where do you think that President-elect Obama starts from on the nuclear question, based on his representations over the last year and a half?
Well, I can tell you what he said, and it's very interesting and it's very promising. Well, first of all, as a senator, one of the things that he did work on was trying to get Russian loose nuclear materials under control with Senator Dick Lugar. So he has an interest in the issue and an acquaintance with it. He's not ignorant of it. But second, during the campaign, on several occasions, he actually embraced the goal of moving to a nuclear weapon-free world. And he specifically cited the Shultz-Kissinger articles. So if he would turn to that politically, there is good reason to think that he would do something.
And what might that look like?
Well, I think, just to begin with,
you said, for example, that you can't really meaningfully expect an aspiring nuclear nation to respond to the demands for a cessation of the pursuit of that course unless the existing nuclear power is prepared to make some concession.
Yeah, well, I think that the concession should be a clear and unequivocal commitment to getting rid of their own arsenals. I think a very simple deal is the key to the whole situation and really is the key to breaking the logjam on proliferation and giving the world the tools that it now lacks to stop proliferation, and that is the nuclear powers should go to the proliferators and indeed to the rest of the world and say, look, we're going to get out of this nuclear business, so don't you get into it. Immediately, a global will would be created to prevent any country, whether currently a possessor or someone who is thinking of building these weapons, to stop them. Right now, look what happens if Iran heads down the path towards a nuclear weapon, perhaps. We don't know if that's what they want, but certainly the nuclear power program they have is a precursor, especially the nuclear energy cycle, fuel cycle. The United States wants to put on severe sanctions. France and Germany and Britain go along, but aren't so enthusiastic. Russia says no. China says no. and nothing happens. The world has no leverage that seems to be effective over a country that wants to proliferate at this point. Same with North Korea. These six-party talks go on forever. We can pray they may lead somewhere, but so far we're very, very far from fulfilling their promise of denuclearizing North Korea. But if, on the other hand, the nuclear powers were themselves going to surrender their weapons and were planning to rely on an abolition treaty to the same extent that they now rely on their nuclear weapons, they would have a united and unanimous will, backed by the 183 countries that already do without nuclear weapons very nicely, to stop proliferation. So I think that the solution to the proliferation problem, which I think would come very quickly, lies in an unequivocal commitment by the United States and the other nuclear powers to get within a determined time period, let's say 10 years, that's what Reagan wanted to do. Reagan and Gorbachev had a 10-year timeline to get out of that business themselves.
Well, surely if there were any opportunity for the incoming administration to fulfill its mandate for change in moral leadership and public policy, following your prescription would be one of the most exciting eventualities of the coming administration. I want to thank Jonathan Schell for being with us tonight in Santa Fe. I want to say that it's really been an honor to be on your journey with you. Thanks to the Lannan folk for sponsoring this. I think Jonathan is going to be signing books outside. I know that this is a tough issue, and there are not a lot of huge jokes associated with this. And fortunately, we've had about 3 or 4 months of Sarah Palin to counter what otherwise is missing. But thanks, everybody, for coming.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.